All right. So I am David Todd Harmon. I work at Manna Nutrition. We help severely malnourished kids fatten up, so well suited for that job. So that's what we do. So we may have a factory in South Georgia where we pump out little peanut butter packets filled with vitamins and minerals and powdered milk, and ship those with various partners across the world, like UNICEF and the U.S. government, whatnot, and try to get those kids from the brink of death back away from that state into little fat, chubby, shiny kids. And so something I love to do, and just privileged to be a part of that. We've been this week spending 3 days kind of looking through the lens of Richard Beck's book, The Slavery of Death. He was with us on Wednesday and just talking about how death anxiety, so the anxiety of actually dying, causes us to do things that are moral failures, causes us to kind of hold on to things rather than loose things. So the book of James and the call of the gospel is calling us to self-emptying, right, to selflessness. The fear of death causes us to hold on. So we went through several things there. If you missed it, I'm sorry. Get the book, read it. It's great. And how, you know, that death can be, you know, death anxiety turns into kind of this neurotic anxiety. So not just our actual physical death, but our the idea of who we are is going to end one day, right? At some point, they don't remember who their great-great-great-grandfather was, and so we try to do things to kind of throw ourselves into the future to outlast our lives, right? Kind of this sort of driven by this neurotic anxiety to be important. And so that was a great image. And anyway, that these two anxieties, our actual survival and our kind of our meaning or our reputation or whatever you want to call that, caused us to just not be neighborly, not be Jesus or be loving. And so we've been wrestling with that. And so the prescription in the book is really to, you know, just be selfless. Well, that sounds great. And that's in some ways easier than others. We talked about, I go to these marriage seminars, I go to a parenting class, or I go to a men's retreat. And so oftentimes I know what I ought to do and just don't do it, right? Those are the ones where I should be a better dad. I think I know how to do that. And some days I do it, some days I don't. And in starting Manna with my buddy Mark, whose wife's here, we didn't know what to do. We didn't know when you start a company and you take the gospel seriously, what does that look like? Like, we knew how to be a better dad. We knew how to be a better husband at times, but we didn't really. I mean, what does it mean to start a company and take the gospel seriously? What does that look like? You know, what do you pay folks? How do you treat people? What policies do you put in place? And so work is kind of the unavoidable self-interest, right? At the end of the day, you're going to draw a paycheck. Like, you're actually acquiring for yourself. And for some of us, acquiring self-esteem and things as well. And so that neurotic anxiety that I touched on. So work for a lot of us is this unavoidable self-interest. And so the gospel is calling us to selflessness. And so we talked about how we wrestle with that and that tension and the anxiety there. And so day two, we had a designer here. So Stephen Kim, a very talented designer, and how he kind of just does life. And so hopefully there's a recording of that. I may have messed it up, so you may have missed that for good. But it was how he does life in terms of taking the gospel seriously, but also running a company that has his name on it. And so this tension of death anxiety and selflessness. And so that was day two. Day three, we have Jason Russell here, founder of Invisible Children, so thrilled to have him, a guy that has something to say in terms of how you live your life in a way that is not paralyzed by fear, but is more putting the gospel and selflessness out front and pursuing that more so than pursuing what Beck said on Wednesday was just, you know, castles made of sand, right, that won't be here just shortly after our death. So, we've been wrestling with that idea of at work, how do we do that? And so really, we use a lot of big language about being advocates and agents of resurrection, or we're called to humanize in this business world where we are constantly just transactionally, you know, transactions. And so how do we humanize those things? We use a lot of big words on Wednesday and even Thursday, but at Manna, we just call it, don't be a jerk. And so Mark actually had a chance to sit down with the old CEO of Hershey. And so Mark said, okay, I'm starting this company. What advice do you have for me? I mean, it's a new company. I don't know what to do, right? I take the gospel seriously and don't know what to do. what advice do you have for me? And he said, don't hire jerks. And Mark said, he's kind of got this dumb look on his face, like, okay, I kind of had that one already. And he said, no, seriously, like, at Hershey, I realized shortly after getting there that when people came in my office, there's a lot of folks I just wasn't happy to see. I mean, he said, you know, smart people, talented people are a dime a dozen. Smart people who aren't jerks. Now, that's something. And Mark said he laughed. And said, no, you're laughing. No, I'm serious. Like, it's hard to find people who are talented and not jerks. And so the way we kind of play that out at Manna is don't be a jerk, right? So take the gospel seriously. Be self-empty, right? Be selfless while also pursuing this goal as a company that has tasks and deliverables and things. And so, again, this tension of how we do that. But that's a quick recap. We have a lot of new faces. I know Jason's a popular guy around here. And so and we're excited to have him. We're going to watch a short video. I think we talked about a pirated video. One of his videos that was a 30-minute long video, the most viral video of all time. You've probably heard of Kony 2012. For those of you that haven't, I found a pirated version that's been pared down to 5 minutes and briefly got his permission this morning to show that. But I'm kidding. So we'll show that real quick, and then we'll jump in with Jason. So welcome.
Thank you.
For 26 years, Kony has been kidnapping children into his rebel group, the LRA, turning the girls into sex slaves and the boys into child soldiers. He makes them mutilate people's faces, and he forces them to kill their own parents. And this is not just a few children. It's been over 30,000 of them. And Jacob was one of those children. The night I first met Jacob, he told me what he and other children in northern Uganda were living through.
We worry the rebel when they raise us again, then they will kill us. My brother tried to escape. Then they killed using power. They cut his neck.
Did you see it?
I saw.
We fear that in your sleep at our home, we can be abducted by the rebels.
Come to save our life.
Everything in my heart told me to do something, and so I made him a promise.
We are also going to do everything that we can to stop them.
Yeah.
Do you hear my words?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Hmm?
Yeah.
We are going to stop them.
This is the head prosecutor for the International Criminal Court. In 2002, when the court was started, their job was to find and demand the arrest of the world's worst criminals. Although there are a lot of warlords, murderers, and dictators in the world, the perversity of Kony's crimes made him first on the court's list.
But the crime basically are things like crimes against humanity and war crimes committed against the civilian population, including murder, sexual slavery, rapes, abductions.
It's obvious that Kony should be stopped. The problem is 99% of the planet doesn't know who he is. If they knew, Kony would have been stopped long ago. But Kony is still out there. He's recently changed his tactics, making it even more difficult to capture him. After 8 years of work, the government finally heard us. And in October of 2011, 100 American advisors were sent into Central Africa to assist the Ugandan army in arresting Kony and stopping the LRA. In order for Kony to be arrested this year, the Ugandan military has to find him. In order to find him, they need the technology and training to track him in the vast jungle. That's where the American advisors come in. But in order for the American advisors to be there, the U.S. government has to deploy them. They've done that. But if the government doesn't believe the people care about arresting Kony, the mission will be canceled. In order for the people to care, they have to know. And they will only know if Kony's name is everywhere. And its only purpose is to stop the rebel group, the LRA, and their leader, Joseph Kony. And I'm about to tell you exactly how we're going to do it. We are going to make Joseph Kony a household name. Not to celebrate him, but to bring his crimes to the light. Our goal is to change the conversation of our culture and get people to ask, who is Joseph Kony? We have printed hundreds of thousands of posters, stickers, yard signs, and flyers that are right now, today, being put up in major cities all over the world. No matter what side you're on, this is something we can all agree on. Start making Kony famous today. But all of these efforts will culminate on one day, April 20th, when we cover the night. This is the day when we will meet at sundown and blanket every street in every city till the sun comes up. We will be smart and we will be thorough. The rest of the world will go to bed Friday night and wake up to hundreds of thousands of posters demanding justice on every corner.
Join us. In making Kony
famous.
Help us spread the word and join us the night of April 20th to help us.
See, that's just that was a trimmed down version that the transitions and whatnot are not Jason's fault. That was some the pirated person's fault. He would do much better. But that was the trimmed down version of a huge campaign that I think most of you that are here probably were a part of that or at least heard about that. But that gave us a little insight into Jason. So tell us about. How you got started in this
book? Well, I love this pirated version so much. I've never seen this until right now. I'm amazed because it's showing that a teenager in her room is taking a 30-minute film and finding the most important parts to convey, right? So this is the new way we're digesting media. It's like anybody, anywhere has the power to tell a story. So it's a totally dismantling of corporatization and the media conglomerates, and the world is changing so dramatically, and a girl in her room could literally, if she tells the story well enough, could have 100 million views overnight. So that's like what's so powerful about and how dramatic the world is now, that it's literally anyone's playing field. It's so exciting to me. I love her cuts. I think she did a great job.
Good.
You kind of get it, right?
I didn't ask.
Because it's like a 10-hour documentary. It's like a Ken Burns documentary because it's a 30-year war based in colonization from 100 years ago, right? It's very complicated and complex, but our goal was to make it into a simple 30-minute digestible for a 14-year-old girl. And she obviously got it. Like, she got the key points.
So tell us how you got started. Initially.
So I got started because my parents started a children's theater organization. I was born into theater, and it's called Christian Youth Theater. And it's basically like a YMCA for children who want to do musical theater. And it's become the largest in the nation now. And so I was always, every day, every night, into the stories, like into all the classic stories and musicals. My dad was a director, so by 12 years old, I was choreographing and directing and writing shows and being in them. But I loved being in the audience the best. That's where I felt, I guess, the most like God, watching the creation happening and being so excited about the story. And I realized in eighth grade that I wanted to tell a story that millions of people could see, and the only way to do that was to be a film director. So I decided to go to USC's film school I got denied three times, but eventually, like, went to the office every day of admissions and said, I have to go here. And after doing that every day for 3 months, the women who do the paperwork, I believe, put mine at the top. So they only accepted 5 transfer students, and 1 didn't want to transfer. And so they called me and said, do you want the spot? And it was the best. I mean, USC's film school is actually the best. It really, really is, because people like Steven Spielberg just show up in your class and you get to talk to him for 3 hours. And so I talked to Steven Spielberg. I said, what do you want to do next? What's your next film? And this is 10, 12 years ago. He said, I want to make a musical. I said, well, perfect. That's what I'm going to do, because I wanted to make Hollywood musicals. And 3 months after that class, I ended up at DreamWorks pitching a story that my girlfriend, who's now my wife at the time, a musical about basically a Romeo and Juliet story updated. And that meeting was 2 weeks before I went to Sudan. And I'm kind of jumping all over the place, but basically one of my friends when I got to USC, his name's Joey, I said, like, we got to talking about the summer, and I'm like, let's do something fun this summer. I've always thought of going to Africa because it seems so exotic, and the dancing, and, you know, you just have this westernization of, like, what could be there. So next time I see him, he goes, I signed us up for a trip, a missions trip, and we're going to go spread the gospel. And I was like, okay, you have to raise $4,000. And so I was like, okay. So started raising the money and got on the plane. I never even Googled the organization. And so we get there, and it was a cult is a strong word, but it was a cult. Like, it was totally a cult. And I was playing the character of Jesus, and you do 30-minute dramas in villages in Africa. So imagine, like, corn-fed America getting off the bus, going into a village of people who are literally dying of HIV/AIDS, don't have shoes, are, you know, hungry. It's like the slums, right? And you're dancing around, like, telling them about Jesus in Swahili. You know, the music plays, but you just dance. And then you go, who wants Jesus? And, like, 100% raise their hand because you're wealthy. Yeah. And they're, like, straight up. But, of course, you realize after you talk to them for a half hour, it's like, they have Jesus. Yeah, you know, like it's totally reversed. Like, their faith is way deeper and stronger than ours. And so I'm scratching my head as we get back on the bus, and I'm like, wait a minute, I want their faith. Like, I actually want their faith. So that really jacked up my faith, because I got home and I went, I don't like religion. I'm not into, like, let me share the gospel with you. And so I read this book called The Poisonwood Bible, which is basically about this Congolese family, or this family from, where are they from? Middle America, I believe, or the South, who go to the Congo in the 50s. And it's like a 400-page book, but there's only one page where a true Christian is personified. And it's this radical dude who, like, lives with them and is totally embedded into their culture and doesn't really share the gospel, just lives. And so that changed my faith, in the sense that I didn't really want to talk about God. I wanted to just more live it out. If there is a God, like, I'd rather just participate it with my body and kind of close my mouth, which is hard for me to do, but That was like the origin story. And I couldn't believe, like, I thought, we learn about the Holocaust, like, every year there's something like 30 to 60 films made in Hollywood about the Holocaust. There's hundreds and hundreds of books written every year still about the Holocaust. And I caught wind of this genocide in Sudan, a genocide happening in real time in Sudan that had a hard time making the news. And I thought, I'm going to go there and document the genocide. I want to make a story about a modern-day genocide and see what that looks like. So, not knowing much, I invited one kid who was 21 and one kid who was 19, a lifeguard in San Diego who had never been out of the country, and we bought a camera off eBay, raised about $10,000. That was our plane tickets and everything we would need, our equipment, and got on a plane knowing... I don't know if they knew, but I knew that we were going to die. Like, I was like, we're probably going to die. I remember being on the British Airways flight and just being like, I'm going to die. Like, we're going to a genocide. Of course you're going to die. So there was, like, such a liberation to that, like, for me, knowing that we were going to die and arriving to the ground and being in a house for, like, 4 days scared to leave the house and then suddenly being like, let's just go explore. And that led us on the adventure of a lifetime. We were praying for a story so much. We just wanted a story. And God gave us a truck in front of us on the road to Gulu from the main city, Kampala. Got shot up a mile in front of us. It was the first time that road was attacked in 4 years. And it was forced us to turn around, and we witnessed the night commuters sleeping in the streets. 17-year war at the time. No journalists were there. Nobody was solving it. The United Nations at the time called it the worst and most forgotten, neglected humanitarian crisis in the world, was where we were with our camera bought off eBay. And we just spent time with the kids and bonded with them and hung out and saw their faith. I mean, these kids who arrived at the center every night in fear of abduction, no shoes, no food, most of their families dead. They're running for their life, scared to be abducted. And they raise their hands in the sky every night, and they are singing, thank you, God, thank you, Jesus, for one more day. I have one more day to be alive. You know, and they're, like, singing it from the depths of their being. And I'm watching them going, I have never been to a church ever like this. This is the best church ever. Because they're literally thankful for the breath in their body. And that just woke me up. I went back and I had to decide whether to make a movie with Steven Spielberg or make this film, Invisible Children. And we chose Invisible Children, not knowing it would be more than a documentary. Because at the time we were just like, here's a movie about something terrible. And every time we showed it to anyone, they said, what could we do to help? And out of that question, we crafted, the answer was basically, what do you do? So we'd always say, like, what can I do to help? I said, what do you do? And people would go, I don't do anything. And I go, you don't do anything? You just sit all day? No. Well, I make food. Awesome. Make food and sell it. Like, every single thing that someone could do could naturally participate in helping this war come to an end and help these children. So that's kind of the origin story of it all. But it's really just been an experiment. The whole, like, every day, every month is just an experiment to see what we could do to make a dent.
So you know, the first few days, anxiety has been something we've talked about a lot of, this basic anxiety. So you went over there, you know, thinking you're going to die. Obviously not that worried about kind of the survival anxiety that a lot of us experience. When you get home, though, is there anybody saying, Jason, like, dude, you can go make this movie with Spielberg or get a real job, or, you know, is there any voice in your life saying...
Oh, they still do to this day. Yeah, my mother-in-law is like, go get a job, you know? Like, go make money. That's what you're supposed to do. Like, feed your children. And in the dark days, like, you do feel like that. You're like, I can't believe I still have debt. Like, I can't believe... You know, you're just like, But I wouldn't trade anything for the journey. Like, I feel like the most blessed person because the adventure has been so extraordinary. Like, I really am amazed at how, in such a short time, like, God has been able to, like, use me. I mean, that's just been the greatest blessing. But I forgot the question.
Worst of your life and discouraged you.
Yeah, I mean, everyone wants, I think that, like, most people in life want to go around discouraging because we have this umbrella of fear and the need to control. And so most of us view ourselves as like wing cutters, you know, where like we have to go out and be like, you really shouldn't do that. It's not smart. And like we go around cutting each other's wings to say like, be fearful. Like don't believe in yourself or like put God in a box because then you'll have more control over what happens next, which is totally counterintuitive to the gospel and the narrative, right? It's just like, and I think that we also live in a very cynical culture, a cynical world, And cynicism, this is Stephen Colbert, he says cynicism masquerades as wisdom, but it's a self-imposed blindness. Because it's easy to be a cynic because then you don't have to participate. You know, you like if you actually participated in it, then you're held accountable. And people would rather sit in the bleachers and be like, they're doing it wrong, they're doing it wrong, they're doing it wrong. And so when people are critical or cynical or try to cut the wings, I actually transform it into petrol fuel in me. Like, I love it. Like, my favorite thing is when someone says, you can't do that. That is illegal. You can't put up posters. I'm like, yeah, let's go do it. It fires me up because that's, I don't know, I'm drawn towards the danger. Like, I love, my son is turning 8 on Sunday, and his middle name is actually Danger. His name's Gavin Danger. Because it's based on a book by this pastor named Michael Iaconelli, and he wrote a book called Dangerous Wonder, The Adventures of Childlike Faith. And it was this idea that Jesus is constantly saying, jump first, fear later. Like, get out of the boat with faith. Walk on water and stare at me. Stay with me. Stay with my eyes. And I will lead you into danger. That's what we're called to do. And so that's where I wake up being like, where's the danger? Hunt for it and step into that. Because when you look at the patterns of the stories in the Bible, like, God traditionally shows up in the impossible, like always in the impossible, right? So you're like, okay, the virgin birth, like parting of the sea, like Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, like he doesn't want to participate in the doldrums and the boring and the mediocre. Like, why would he be there? So that's, you know, I love death. I think it's the coolest invention of the storyteller in the sky. You know, it's like, I have an idea. What if they die? Like, that will hopefully motivate them to live. I think that's, like, the greatest thing. And I love the concept of thinking that there's no empathy in heaven because empathy is systemically based in our understanding of death. So That's a great thought that, like, we only empathize with each other because of our mirror neurons in the brain. And the mirror neurons are saying, you're in pain, then I'm in pain. You're happy, I'm happy. And, you know, I just keep thinking, I stop saying God because God kind of, it hurts people. Like, they don't know where, they've been damaged by it so much that they're like, it's almost like a trigger word for people with, you know, PTSD. So I like to think of it just as the storyteller with no gender. Like, it's just a storyteller who's like, I want to tell a story because I'm infinite and I'm going to make this, like, temporal experiment with dramatic contrast and see what happens and enjoy the process of that. Because at our best, I think we are all creating, right? When you think about who you are, writing, cooking, sports, like, we love the process of creating, and that's because we're made in the image of the ultimate creator, and we get to co-create with that ultimate creator. So that's kind of the sweet spot, is knowing that we're participating in this co-creator who wants to show up in the impossible if we step out of the boat.
So, like, the lovely concept of you, this kind of fearlessness, and, you know, you're 19, and some of us get that. So we get, it's, you know, it's easy to be fearless at 19 sometimes. We're all that way.
Yeah.
But you've gotten married, you've had a kid, you said, I still have debt. Like, I'm not, this is, you know, I've had a lot of success in these movies, but personally, it's come at a cost. Mm-hmm. So was there ever a time when you thought, kind of reconsidered, like, oh my goodness, like, I'm married with a kid or two kids.
Yeah.
Like, at what point do I grow up, you know, the cynicism, wisdom.
Yeah, that's a great question, because I actually love the American dream. Like, I'm like, wow, I mean, we're going to rent for the rest of our lives, I think, but, which is great, you know, like, something breaks and you're like, it broke, you know, you don't have to think about selling it or mortgage or anything like that, and I think it's a fiction to, like, own anything in this world. You know, it's like, really? You own that? It's like, you're going to actually turn into dust. You don't own anything. So that's like the new narrative when you said like he was talking about sharing. It's like we definitely have enough stuff on Earth to share. We don't need to buy anything. I mean, maybe new things like a watch that is a computer. That's fine. But like, you can't own or copyright, really? Like, no. I just think that we, as a species, I hope we evolve into this idea of let's just share everything. And I pray that it's the people who Christ is the master are the ones to lead the way. You know what I mean? Like, I see a church that is, like, the buildings actually transform into hospitals, into schools. I don't know if you caught wind of the San Francisco church. You should Google it. It's such a good story where they installed sprinkler systems around the church because too many homeless people were sleeping outside the church. And so they were literally turning the sprinklers on to spray away the homeless people because they're urinating on the church. And I'm like, I love the line of Mother Teresa. She's like, Jesus comes in the most interesting disguises. You know, like, I literally think Jesus is urinating on the church and being like, hi, we didn't see you there. I'm urinating on the building because it's actually, you know, so I see it as this really beautiful time of the church awakening, you know, because we've studied it. We've studied the scriptures. We know it. It's time, the school's out. Like, it's out now. And the young generation are really getting it. They're like, they are like closing their mouths, not evangelizing, and just doing it with their hands. Like going around, and you see them, and you just like, you get it. You don't even have to talk. You're like, you're on my team, let's go. You know? And so it's like preaching with your hands and feet, which when you study communication, it's something like 80% is nonverbal. 80% of communication is nonverbal. And so what one of my mentors says is like, he says, I can't hear what you're saying and I can't believe what you're saying through all that you're doing. And I'm like, yeah, that's really true. And that's convicting even for me because I talk a lot. And so it's kind of like going back to the Gandhi, you be the change you want to see in the world. And I didn't get that until even this last year, even though I heard it for a long time.
Tell us about this.
Yeah.
Your fearless journey with Invisible Children took kind of full circle, right? As of January.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, so we built Invisible Children to not be sustainable. We did not want to keep working there. Like, it's adventurous because we make it joyful and adventurous, but like waking up every day knowing that more children are being slaughtered, it's not the best job. You kind of want to like graduate from that job. And so we didn't want to sustain Invisible Children, but we did want to be alive for the war to end. And so instead of closing down and locking the key and shutting off the website, we realized that we were going to fire all of our staff, including ourselves, the founders and the CEO, and just keep four people working there, which there's four in D.C. working there, specifically on the programs who are bringing more LRA women and children home, and our lobby advocacy D.C. Presence. And so the four people who work there started as interns, and now they're running the whole organization. And in December, I fired myself from Invisible Children because I realized, and it was really hard to realize, but I realized that I had done my job. That I'm a storyteller, I'm a filmmaker, and could I have done it better? Probably not. I mean, it's the most viral video of all time still, and so, like, I sense God being like, you're done, like, move on. And my ego and my pride was really strong. I kept being like, and mad. I was so angry at God. I was like, this is how the story ends? This story sucks. Like, really? Coney wins? This is the end of the story? Are you joking? You're the God of justice? Really? So it was hard. It was so hard for me to, like, let go of that. But as I did and finally really surrendered this thing that I thought I had owned or built or inspired, God brought me directly to International Justice Mission, which, if you guys don't know, International Justice Mission is a team of lawyers, and after 20 years of doing this work against, like, basically violence in the world, around the world, they are freeing the most slaves in the world right now, today. They free slaves every single day, all around the world, by working with local governments and police forces to enforce the law, because slavery is actually illegal in every country in the world. And what they're committed to, and they know they're doing it in God's name through prayer and His work, they're going to free all 35 million slaves in our lifetime, if not in the next 10 to 15 years. And so I arrived to the Global Prayer Gathering, their conference, 3 weeks ago, and I am like, I'm a critic. Like, I can be like, this isn't good. And I was blown away. Like, the stories that are coming out of International Justice Mission are Moses stories. They are praying in God's name on their face. Slaves are being freed. They're like, hallelujah. And they're so sophisticated. They're so intelligent. They're so fearless. And they're so humble and hopeful. I am like, the church, so my job now, I'm consulting for them, but I'm creating a campaign and a movement around this slavery narrative to wake up the faith community to participate in a very real way in ending slavery. Because when Jesus came into the temple, right, he grabbed Isaiah and said, I have come to set the captives free. I've come to give sight to the blind, right? This is really what Jesus came to do. And so what is more the least of these than a woman who's being raped 12 times a day in a dungeon? Like, that is the lowest, most degrading, most despicable, most horrific scar on the body of God. And so it's our job to show up. And I believe we will, because the kerosene is on. The kerosene is already on everything, and we're just going to light the match. Boom! And it's going to light a fire, I believe, within the body like we've never seen. Like, I don't think we're prepared for it, but we're going to wake up. Because the church really, we know this, you guys know, the church has been sleeping with its eyes open. And so it's hard to wake up from your sleep, right? When you're asleep, you don't know how to wake up. But either God's going to do it in an abrasive way where it's like, or he's going to do it, or she's going to do it, whatever. The storyteller's going to do it in a very loving, gentle way, because God is so patient and kind. You could just like rub your back and be like, hi, I need you to do this work to help children not starve to death. You know, we have the ability to make sure they don't. So I can't wait, only because I think the world will look upon it and go, who are these people? Who are these crazy people? And they'll be like, they like Jesus. And they're like, really? It's not the UN. It's not Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It's not the Bill Clinton Foundation. It's not all the things and structures and governments that are supposed to solve the problems. It's the body of the Savior doing it. Wow. What a great story. Yeah.
So we're actually getting fairly close on time. So I want to bring that to the micro level.
Yeah.
Folks here, these are preachers, teachers, mentors. They're going to go back to their churches, and they're hopefully going to take this lens of the slavery of death and try to get the people to live more selflessly, right, in the kind of combat the fear of death. And so there's kind of two ways to change a lot of times. There's kind of all-at-once change, and so hopefully there will be folks who go home and they encourage people to, you know, forego their 401ks and their, you know, I'm not worried about benefits and actually go and do something like you, right? So it's not something that's kind of bold and fearless. And the other folks are going to need to take a step tomorrow, right? That's not going to be in Uganda. It's going to be, how do I be less of a jerk tomorrow than I was yesterday?
Yeah.
How do you, every day, in your small interactions with colleagues or friends or wife, kids, whatever, how are you in these, what we said on Wednesday, small acts of asceticism, right, of self-emptying. How do you do it in small ways? Because you're obviously very good at doing it in big ways.
Yeah, I'm actually learning how to do that. I'm actually learning how to do that because it's always like big for me. And so I've been really getting into Mother Teresa's ideology and philosophy. And what I've noticed just even in the last 3 weeks is how God has been able to provide everything specifically, perfectly when you need it. Like, I can't believe when I look and I see my hands and I see my children and then my dog. And so it always, you know, she said, start in your home, always. Like, because think about all the homes that are broken. So you start just with what you have right there. And it's been my wife and I. Like, these issues, we've known each other for, 27 years. We've been married for 10. And I'm finding things about our relationship that are dysfunctional. And so it's like, okay, how do I pour myself out to this, you know? Because my wife's like, you do whatever you want, and we adjust. And I'm like, whoa. Like, that's a real raw statement. So there, and then my dog is actually teaching me a lot, because when I get mad at him, I smack him. And, like, that's not a good way to do it. You know what I mean? Like, I have anger issues, and he's teaching me, like, why do you hit me? Like, I'm like, oh, gosh, how do I work that out? Because he's, like, barking at the wrong time. And so it's, like, very small ways, you know, and I do participate in the practice of, like, washing the dishes as though you're doing it for God himself, like, as though that's God, and trying to get into that practice, because it's the journey's actually internal, you know. And I heard that for so long, but it didn't resonate until recently. And then it starts to grow, your neighbor, right, and then, like, the people at your work, and being, you know, it's, to me, the Hafiz poem, which the storyteller is so brilliant, because anybody anywhere in the world can get it. And here's the poem, which is what I'm trying to practice at all times. Even after all this time, the sun never says to the earth, you owe me. Look what happens with a love like that. It lights the whole world. And so in the design, the sun's been in space through a vortex flying into infinity for billions of years, for 10,000 years. It doesn't matter to an infinite God. It's been going for a long time. And the entire time it's going, you owe me nothing. Because God is perfect. And perfection is defined by something is so good you can't take anything away from it and you can't add anything to it. It's like an egg. An egg is perfect. You just look at the design. It's perfect. And so we cannot add anything to God. We cannot give anything to God to make him stronger or more or better. The only thing we can do is the way we treat the sun in the sky to receive it. That's it. And so how do you yourself turn into the sun? Because that's what Jesus was saying. You are the light of the world. You are. And we're like, we are? Yeah. And so Mother Teresa was like, I'm going to live my life and literally never ask anyone. No one owes me anything. And by participating like that, she lit the entire world on fire for the love of the Savior. And so that's where my heart's at. And when you think about it in that lens, the idea of a mortgage or like money in the bank or like those things that love to creep up. Trust me, I've been there and I've been a slave of like, oh my gosh, how are we going to do it? It starts to fade away, you know, because you're just like, we moved into this house recently last week and, but we were, all four of us, our family was committed. We're like, we would be just as happy in a hut. I promise you that. Or just nomad, like the Maasai, like just who cares? Like, and when you get to that place, there is a freedom. There's a freedom to it.
So I read an article that last month. It was 3 years after COVID in 2012. You know, where are they now kind of thing. One of those kind of articles. I'm trying to be real fair about it. And one of the reason I included the Black Lives Matter slide was that they said COVID in 2012, as big of a deal as it was for the LRA, it actually has seemed to inspire groups of people, kind of voiceless, marginalized people, and convince them that collectively they have a voice. Yeah. So Black Lives Matter or all these different, you know, they had several examples of these in the past couple of years of folks that have used social media and used, you know, folks that individually have nothing but collectively have been able to
bring about change in the world. I thought that's quite a tip of the hat to some of the work that you've done, and it really reminded me of some of the things in here. And so the last chapter of this book, Beck talks about the freedom of God. And so for there to be a prophetic voice, God has got to be free to speak to you. And so it actually uses the idea of that if God is always agreeing with you, it's likely that your God is on the shelf as an idol versus this prophetic God. So I was hoping to end just reading that
so good.
That half page. So I hate to, hopefully you can stay with me here and read that. And then there's one of the last sentences, and then open up for a couple quick comments or maybe a final thought from your end, because we're a little bit past time already. So quickly I'll read this. If you have to go, feel free to walk out. I'll talk loud. But in Beck, talking about the freedom of God, he says this. He says, the capacity for prophetic imagination, that God is free to be against us, is the great weapon against idolatry. Whenever and wherever the people of God lose this capacity, God becomes enslaved. When the prophetic imagination is eclipsed, when God can no longer be imagined as being against us or for those that we oppress, exclude, stigmatize, marginalize, ignore, or aggress against, God is no longer free but a slave. In that event, with the silencing of the prophetic voice within the faith community, or those voices of critique from the outside, God is no longer God, but a principality and power, a tool of the devil, leading us into sin. And what might be the sign of the eclipse of the prophetic voice? What are the symptoms of this failure of the prophetic imagination? Simply put, the alignment of, equating of, and identification of our voice as interests with God's own. This occurs when we speak for God with no remainder, when we see ourselves as God's favored ones engaged in holy crusades, when the current power arrangements are legitimized as being ordained or endorsed by God. In these instances, God has been captured, and the demonic dynamics of our slavery to death are soon set into motion. Dogmatism, triumphalism, and exceptionalism are clear attitudinal indicators here, but the clearest behavioral sign is the failure of kenosis, self-emptying, with the onset in the name of God, of grasping, protecting, and aggressing rather than emptying, serving, and giving. When we can hear the voice of God crying out against us in the voices of those we ignore, marginalize, victimize, exclude, ostracize, harm, and kill, we know that God has been set free. And so anyway, as I said earlier, the fact that you've been, a lot of the work you've been a part of has been giving voices to these folks, I feel like drives home the point of how living fearlessly it allows voices that are generally oppressed or pushed down, right, to be exalted. I think there's something there. So I'll give you 1 minute, 1.5 minutes. I got to get these folks to their keynote.
Yeah. I mean, I would just, getting into Mother Teresa one more time is just, I never heard it put this way. She said that we need to love the type of love that causes us pain and hurts us, but brings us great joy. So we should pray for the courage to love like that. And so that's what I have been pushed into, because we don't really grasp the pain and suffering, why the storyteller wants us to feel that. But when we come through that, when we come through those crucified moments of our lives, it's the great lesson, right? It's the great liberator. And without that suffering and pain, we wouldn't have ever experienced it. So I guess that's what all, when the gospel and all the letters are like, rejoice in the prison, rejoice in the pain. Like, the pain is the point, because it refines and refines and refines and refines. And so that's kind of the idea of like running towards danger. And my journey is so different than yours. Everyone in the room is uniquely designed in its own time and space. And so if you see what we've done or I've done as an inspiration, awesome. But don't think that you have to go free the slaves or help the child soldiers, but do something that is participatory in a more dangerous life. Like, because God will meet you there, and you will see yourself having the things you need, be it money or connections or whatever, as you go through it. And I'm sure you've experienced those moments in your life where you're like, this is definitely in God's will, because it's just aligned. So that's kind of the sweet spot. But
so thank you for being here. Safe travels. And thank you, Jason, for coming on the show.